Hello, Walter Russell Mead. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. This is Glenn Lowry at the Glenn Show at Blogging Heads and at Brown University, and I'm really pleased and privileged to be talking with Walter Russell Mead, the distinguished historian and writer, commentator on American affairs, international and domestic, professor at Bard College. Walter, I invited you on because I just saw a comment that you might have been making in passing about the moving events attendant to the burial, the celebration of the life and the commemoration of the lives of the people who were the victims of this shooting in the church in Charleston, South Carolina. The president gave a storied speech there. There was a ceremony and an event with the African American church, the idiom and rhythms and voice of that church being very prominent at that moment of national mourning. And you observed, and I should not try to speak for you, about the power and profundity, centrality to the American experience of the Black church in a way that I was moved by. And I thought it would be worth our time to, share your thoughts about that with the audience here, and just kick it around a bit as to what it all means and where we are now, where we've come from, and so forth like that. So, please, would you, with that sort of setting of the stage, sort of take the microphone here and let us know your thoughts.
All right. Well, it when that shooting happened, I was actually in Berlin at a conference, and it was being run by the Green Party in Germany, and the conference was being hosted in a hotel where Martin Luther King had stayed when this part of Berlin was East Berlin in the communist years. And there were pictures of King all over the hotel, but also I learned that this hotel had been a kind of a Christian center in East Germany under communist rule. It's one of the few places where sort of Christians had some public space. The fact that King stayed there gave this hotel visibility and credibility with the communist government, made it harder for them to shut it down. And so that the sort of combination of being there and seeing the impact that King, who was obviously very much a product of the American Black Church, had on Christian life in Germany, really made me think. And then when, at the arraignment in court, where the friends and the families of the victims told the accused murderer that they forgave him, and it was clear that that was coming from the heart. And then you saw the power of the ceremony at the church. I don't think there was a dry eye anywhere when they went into singing "Amazing Grace." It just brought home to me in this profound way, what a force in American history the Black Church has been. And I couldn't help but also thinking, we don't think about that enough. We don't study that experience enough. It doesn't get the attention it deserves. So that was kind of the launching of my thoughts there.
I see a number of interesting strands in that, especially this last, and I wonder why it does not get the attention that it deserves, given that African American culture and other activities and televangelists and so forth or whatever are also very prominent. Given that you would think that we'd be very proud of the accomplishments of associated with the civil rights movement and the role the church has played, and one wonders why it wouldn't be more celebrated. But I also am struck, I won't go on, by the observation of the influence in the global context of of Martin Luther King being remembered in this Berlin, of even the practice of Christianity having just a little bit more breathing room at that particular place by virtue of the fact that he had been there, and all of that. So the extending beyond our own, you know, national boundaries. It's an American drama, but it's also global in the same way that, I don't know, the South African, liberation struggle stands out in global imagination. So too does the African-American struggle here in the United States, and so on.
Yep. Well, you know, also the fight against King Leopold and what he was doing in the Congo. The guy who exposed that was an African-American journalist who'd been very much kind of formed and educated in the African-American church.
Oh, you know, I know that story just a little bit from having read years ago Adam Hochschild's book, King Leopold's Ghost. Yeah. Ed Morrell is the name I remember. That was the Brit. And I do remember this African-American, but I cannot recall his name, Walter.
You know what? I'm going to have to look that one up.
Oh, okay.
Because
no problem.
You're right. But no, he was a journalist. I remember I wrote about him in Special Providence because I was trying to make a... I was looking at the way that, you know, sort of non-elite groups in American history have had an impact on the world. And the mission movement has always been one of the ways. And I was startled because I didn't realize that even before the Civil War, African-American churches in the U.S. were supporting overseas mission work. And were actually sending missionaries overseas.
Before the Civil War.
Before the Civil War. Again, I think people don't sometimes recall or sufficiently pay attention to the reality that the first genuinely independent African-American organizations were usually churches, African Methodist Episcopal churches in most cases.
Oh, yeah.
Where, you know, again, believers who had been either... kicked out of white churches or told to go sit in the balcony where their contributions had helped build the church, formed their own churches. And these were public spaces where African Americans selected the leadership, had the autonomy to organize the worship, the educational programs, and they became centers of community life. And this goes back into the 18th century.
Well,
and by the night,
yeah, go,
sorry,
no, go ahead.
And by the 19th century, again, before the Civil War, you have a significant number of these independent parishes. Some were even operating in southern states, although in South Carolina they suppressed them. In Charleston, they suppressed the free black churches. And then after the Civil War, in early Reconstruction times. A lot of the African-American denominations set up mission parishes to work with the newly freed slaves across the South for both kind of religious, educational, and community building purposes.
Yes, sir.
So this is, you know, then you look at, I mean, I think in some ways the most phenomenal example of the way that the black church has changed life in the United States, not just for blacks, but for whites, and then globally had an impact, is it often seems to me we don't pay enough attention to what happened to African Americans in the South between Reconstruction and the 1950s. That is, in the 1860s and 70s, even with some federal help, however half-hearted at times it was, these communities were not really able to defend themselves against the attack by the Klan and other forces on their freedoms and on their political rights. But then in the 1940s and 50s, these communities, often without as much federal help as they had in Reconstruction, are able to wage a successful battle for civil rights across the South with ramifications everywhere. And you look at why that was, and clearly a major factor is that during those two generations all over the South, in community after community after community, these African American churches provide the community organization, the leadership, the education, the vision that enables these communities to organize politically and to go out and change things. And that's a story that of, you know, what, how did blacks respond to the imposition of Jim Crow, the defeat of the freedmen after the Civil War? How did they respond? And how did they change things? And that story and the story of the black church, I think, are very much connected. Obviously, Martin Luther King being here a central figure.
At the end of this period of post-Reconstruction transition.
Yes, exactly. But he, of course, he's a member of kind of a clerical dynasty.
Yeah, indeed. And so the resources that were being drawn on, religious and civic communal, had been honed over several generations of post-emancipation, but not yet freedom, life of African-Americans in the South. And that kind of comes to a fruition, but you're saying, and I find persuasive, that perhaps we don't look quite enough at what the dynamics of that period were, a period in which, for example, a figure like Booker T. Washington would loom very large, perhaps even larger than a figure like W.E.B. Du Bois, if we were to talk about the communal dynamic. And I'm not making a political observation here. I'm making what I think might be an accurate historical observation about African-American history.
I mean, I agree. I think how these communities went from, you know, kind of, the defeat of their hopes in Reconstruction, and then existing under tremendous pressure and restriction, a rule of terror, you know, and lynch law, systematic economic discrimination, how they nevertheless built foundations, organizations, the sort of moral discipline, I mean, to carry on a nonviolent struggle under those conditions, you don't just wake up in the morning and do that. That requires the construction of an infrastructure. It requires people to develop ideas of human dignity and to learn to sort of live to their beliefs in a certain way. All of this is being mediated through, you know, the black colleges that Booker T. Washington and others formed, George Washington Carver. But above all, it's the church, which is the one space that can't be closed down. Again, an institution run by blacks, for blacks, according to the ideas of African-American leaders. And this creates a community which in time is able to win its freedom.
Okay, now I have to say here, because I can hear it, I teach at Brown University, I can hear from my colleagues and from my students what a certain kind of response would be, which I want to try to articulate now. And that would be having to do with the juxtaposition to black power, to the Nation of Islam, to Malcolm X, to black nationalism, black radicalism, to urban unrest and violence, to the interplay between the dynamic that Martin Luther King finally is at the head of in terms of a petition for civic equality to America, which makes reference to magnificent promissory notes, which talks about the implications of our common Christian confession and so on, which explicitly eschews violence and wraps itself in a Gandhian thing. They would juxtapose that to something else, okay? Something that was looking outside of the United States into Africa, something that saw Christianity as a white man's religion, something that hadn't, quote, drunk the Kool-Aid, if you see what I'm saying, that didn't really believe in America. And the claim would be made, I'm sure, by many, that such relative equality and standing of African Americans as we enjoy today is the fruit of both of those things. Moreover, the conservatism of this black church tradition, the piety of it, the Victorian moral reflexes of it, Booker T. Washington. The social conservatism on abortion or on gay rights or whatever, this would be brought to the surface and, would be seen in a negative light. So I'm just wondering how, if, I'm trying to stand in for something that wouldn't necessarily be my personal view, but that I know would be strongly felt by a lot of people, how you'd respond to that concern, set of concerns.
Well, I think there are a number of responses. And one of them is obviously that more than, in a great historical change, more than one force is always going to be at work. And so I'm certainly not going to try to stand here and say that the African-American church is the only force that had a significant impact on African-American history in the 20th century. That just wouldn't be true. But when we try to think about how life changed for African-Americans, particularly in the South, I was born in South Carolina. That's really kind of, I think about things as a Southerner, even though I've been living in the North most of my life. What you see is a movement, and I remember this from, my father and my grandfather's various involvement in things. You saw in kind of town after town, city after city, you would see changes. And what typically happened was that the black clergy were the recognized leaders of the black community in these southern cities and towns. And in some cases, they led demonstrations or supported student groups who led demonstrations. But when it came to, okay, we've got, when the white power structures recognize that change has to happen and it needs to be discussed and negotiated, it's this indigenous African-American leadership that manages that transition, that works through the new way we're going to live. And it's very often out of those people, and it wouldn't just be the clergy, there'll be the lawyer, the African-American professional class of these towns, but which is, generally speaking, very, very closely tied to the church leadership. This group has a strength and a cohesion and has the trust and respect of enough of the masses that it's really able to act politically and bring these changes about.
Now I noticed that you're using the present tense in those most recent sentences, though you were speaking of the historical process of blacks' civil rights and claims coming out of South Carolina as you did. But I'm wondering, and I want to ask you directly, the extent to which you see is relevant to contemporary issues, whether it be the Ferguson, Missouri, and the Baltimore and so forth, or whatever, the contemporary racial issues of this tradition and of this set of institutions, the Black Church and so on. Is it merely something that we want to use to understand American history, or do you see this class, you say, this class of ministers and professionals? I could even see you being, perhaps criticized for waxing nostalgic about a era of segregation, black colleges and so forth, which were, the forced response to oppression and, no, we don't have them anymore because we don't need them anymore, kind of thing like that. So what would you say about that?
Well, I think some people need them, some people don't, maybe. But just to connect up internationally before I come back to the country.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, one of the things that I've been advocating for is that American policy in support of human rights globally we should be learning from how that worked at home. We should actually be thinking about, say, for example, in a country like Egypt.
Yeah.
And we should look at how did the social infrastructure develop that enabled African Americans to achieve freedom and defend it and build it. And this idea of through education, through creating kind of islands of of light. That, again, just as the you know, blacks for years didn't openly challenge the power structure of the South until that community was ready to do it. A kind of a, you know, thinking of a gradual, multi-generational capacity-building approach to human rights might actually work a lot better than some of the things that we've been doing. So it actually, it occurs to me that the experience of African Americans in the South is not going to be for everywhere and everybody, but is a useful piece of a useful historical example, and even to some extent a template that can be applied to help us think about advances in human dignity in other societies. So all I think right. I think we need to learn from that history and use that history.
I find that to be a very interesting thought. I mean, it makes me wonder, so how do you pressure a government? I don't know if this is what you would say. I'm really asking you. It may have been much more effective over the long run for the change that did eventually reach fruition in the 1950s and 60s to have come about through the progressive building of a stronger and more effective leadership and advocacy cadres amongst African Americans, buttressed by a thick civic, sort of social capital and whatnot, than for a kind of blanket imposition to come by edict, threatening, I don't know what, sanctions or the withholding or the whatever, from the outside without. I mean, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. And I could see how a person might then say about Egypt or somewhere else, if you really want to see change there that's going to matter and that's going to stay, it's got to be buttressed by something more than the, you know, U.S. Wagging their fingers in the face of forces that we disagree with there.
Exactly. To some degree, Glenn, it seems to me that some of our civil rights policy looks like kind of reconstruction in the sense of top down, outside in, and generally speaking, maybe not a lot of sustained will behind it, as opposed to something that comes from within, is based on capacities that have been developed inside and represents the kind of maturing of trends in civil society.
I want to explore this a little bit, because are you making a kind of respectability argument in part? I'm asking you, really. I'm not accusing you, and I'm not trying to put words on it. Are you saying, in virtue of the fact that this long-suffering African-American middle class and clergy leadership and professionals and so on, by virtue of the fact that they had arisen and stood on their own 2 feet and begun to articulate for themselves, that they could be more effective and more persuasive, that they had somehow earned a greater hearing and a greater consideration, and that such a willingness to take seriously on the part of the white median voter was a necessary precondition to ultimately bringing about the change that we all now celebrate?
I'd put it a little bit differently. I'd say that what they did was they developed a clear capacity for self-government and developed such sort of clarity, dignity, and organizational power that they couldn't be resisted. Or they could be resisted, they couldn't be defeated. And yes, part of this, I think, was that, you know, by the time, say, my grandfather, who was a doctor in Florence, South Carolina, and during the 1950s and 60s, he was kind of involved a bit in the sort of, you know, discussions between blacks and whites in Florence about how those changes would come about. What he and the people around him would see would be that they were dealing with some very serious people who understood, who were absolutely capable. You couldn't think of a rational reason to limit their participation in governance or to see them as anything other than somebody absolutely capable of anything you can think of. And I think that perception among some whites did undermine their resistance to civil rights for blacks. But I think that had a real impact. But again, what I'd say is the main reality here is that black people in the American South, beginning in the 40s, certainly in the 50s and 60s, had developed this immense capacity for effective political action that, you know, once it got in motion, they were able to create a movement that could not be stopped.
So, Walter, how do you place and how do you think about the radicalism that emerges in the 1960s against this backdrop about the, you know, the Stokely Carmichaels and the Black Panther Party, about the civil disorder in the big urban areas that the Kerner Commission reports on by the end of the decade?
Yeah.
And that certainly had to have a profound salience in terms of affecting white attitudes and the perception of the legitimacy of African-American claim. Is that a counterpoint to the tendency that you've been extolling, or what?
Well, again, I think once, you know, I think it's an aspect of the, once you, you know, as blacks get more space and win more space, they're able to express a wider variety of ideas, and more people are getting access to education, and they're reading more things and developing more ideas. All of that, it seems to me, is what happens. I mean, if you looked at white kids in the 1960s, you would also see radicalization, new ideas, rebellions, and violence, for that matter. So in part, there's a kind of a global encounter of American society with global thought and global perspectives that you see happening among many different racial and ethnic and cultural subgroups in America. So I'm not sure how yeah. exceptional that is.
But I
do think it's worth noting, Glenn, that the big victories in terms of, you know, Civil Rights Act, sort of a Voting Rights Act, accommodations, all of these things actually take place really before the momentum in the movement itself has been, you know, sort of, you know, has been taken over, so to speak, by the radical next generation. The big victories are won before the radicalization.
Yeah, that's a point well taken, and one can count on the fingers of one hand the big victories that have been won since.
Well, I think that's, again, I think that's right. Now, I think there's another issue going on here, which, again, you know, it's not, in my mind, a racial issue particularly. It's a sociological one, and that is that You can actually read about this in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And he talks about how there are two kinds of religion that you find in the Britain of his day. You have one kind of religion that's very, as he says, very liberal, doesn't really put a lot of pressure on binding people by rules and regulations. Then you have these kind of sectarian religions, as he calls them, you know, the congregations with the fiery preaching and the,
yeah.
you know, the strict moral discipline. And the point that Smith makes is that rich people can live with a lax religion. He says, you know, a well-placed young British male can sort of indulge in several years of dissipation without it materially affecting his life's prospects. But for the workman, you know, newly come to the city from the country,
yeah.
he spends 2 weeks drinking, and, you know, gin in those days was the big drug, and, you know, sort of character, economic prospects, everything can be destroyed. And that so that these churches that provide social discipline and community for poor people when the odds are really stacked against them, Those are really necessary for a lot of people trying to live, you know, build ordered lives in a chaotic society where they don't have many advantages.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways we do, you know, when you think about solutions for people in poverty today, we can talk about social policies and all, and those, there are many that do need to change, but it's still the construction of these communities within which people can be supported as they try to live meaningful lives and get in touch with the kind of power that can help them overcome their disadvantages, their past experiences. I think here churches still have a major role to play that maybe nobody else can play.
I strongly agree with that, Walter, and I'm so glad you articulated it with the clarity and depth that you just did. This is the kind of thing that I've been saying over the years for a long time. I've had the privilege of working with some people on the ground, community activists and stuff who are, involved in the civil society work of, trying to move people off of drug addiction, out of prostitution, out of serial incarceration, abandonment of their children and things like that. I will mention Robert Woodson, who leads the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise. People will call this black conservatism. I don't think partisanship has any real role to play here. I won't go on long here because you've just said it, but I think the issues are, how do you actually change human behavior? What are the instruments available to be effective in that regard? What's the limits to a bureaucratic and sort of state mediated intervention, which is constrained by all manner of various factors? And what sources of human motivation and have the lasting capacity to actually get somebody out of what would otherwise be a disaster? So you made reference to Adam Smith's observation with respect to poverty and who can afford a lax religion. And I think it's so true that if I can reach a person at the level of an understanding about who and whose they are and what the meaning of life is, and lead them into a reconsideration of their behavior on those grounds, I go much, much further than I can by, incentivizing them with a marginal transfer, carrots and sticks, threatening to punish, reward and so forth and so on, a kind of B.F. Skinner approach to human behavior. So this is a power that African-Americans in our condition, I would want to say, and I'll just finish up here, are especially, in need of mobilizing and should treat with great seriousness. So anyway, I just express my agreement with you. I want to ask you about something else, if I can, if you still got a moment.
Sure.
That's the forgiveness thing. The survivors of these martyrs who were slaughtered in the senseless act of murder that was perpetrated in that South Carolina church, they stood at an inquest, or not an inquest, but you know what I mean, an arraignment. Confronting Dylan Roof, the alleged assailant there. And they made these statements of forgiveness. Now, I have seen a lot of commentary on social media about this, some of it coming from African-American people who say, you got to be kidding me. Give me a break. Forgive what? I ain't forgiven nobody, kind of thing like that. And other people just expressing befuddlement. And others expressing doubt about the sincerity of it. They thought that's what they needed to say or what people wanted to hear, but who could really be believing that? Well, as somebody, you talked about the African-American Episcopal Church, the AME Church, its founding, Richard Allen, Absalom Jones, and all those.
Yep.
I mean, that's a church I know a little bit of something about. I was taken there when I was a kid to that denomination, and I ended up on my own account as an adult coming back to the church in an AME, a parish. And I know a little bit of something about where that inclination toward forgiveness is coming from. And I don't think they were putting on an act at all. I think that they really meant it. I think it was a manifestation of the fruit of the Spirit. It was proof of the depth of the transformative power of Christianity. It was a testimony of faith. And it was absolutely unbelievable to see it acted out. But I don't think the power of it, the deep meaning of it, should be lost amid, some kind of partisan commentary. I think it was really a statement about the tremendous power of Christian faith in the lives of people who believe.
I absolutely agree. And, what sometimes I think people who, don't have a lot of experience, for people whose lives, and it sounds like, yours and mine, we at least try to be here, that that for us the experience of unconditional grace and forgiveness, you know, makes that a clear, you know, we can understand the importance of it because we've received it. But for people who don't have that experience, it's helpful, I think, to maybe understand that when you don't forgive, when you can't forgive, then you are handing power over your life to the perpetuator of evil, perpetrator of evil. That if your life is going to be entire, you know, if you're holding on to this anger and bitterness, rage, fury, that person, the cause of this is in control of you. And if your entire life is shaped by action, reaction, then in addition to the harm that's done with the murder and so on, there's this harm of warping and ruining your soul and your depriving you of your freedom. And that the ability to forgive is also the ability to overcome and to have a life that's not defined by being a victim, of being, you know, someone who's been hurt in some way. You are refusing to let this evil have the final voice in who you are or what you do. And it's not, you know, it's not passivity. Again, if you look at the history of it, the formation of the Black Church, the rise of the Black Church, the social power of the Black Church is the core organizational force of the human rights, of the struggle for civil rights and freedom. So forgiveness is not some kind of, you know, passive, I can't do anything, I'm hopeless, I'm helpless. It's a step in building individuals and building communities who are not defined by what other people do to them, but who are defined by the ideals they live for and the goals they're striving toward. So the power of Christian forgiveness goes far beyond, you know, what some people see as this kind of mealy-mouthed, oh, I forgive. I do remember Mark Twain has one of his characters in Pudd'nhead Wilson. She says, I forgive you as a Christian. And Twain adds, which meant she didn't forgive him at all. you know, but genuine forgiveness is actually deliverance from the power of evil.
That's very well said. There must be a preacher somewhere in your family tree, Walter. I speculate.
My father is a preacher, and I have to say one of the formative experiences for him was his involvement in the civil rights movement. He had the privilege to march with Martin Luther King.
I see.
It comes to me through that channel.
I want to ask you about the Confederate flag. You were born in South Carolina, and you write prolifically about American affairs. I'm sorry that I do not know if you've written any pieces on the flag controversy, but I wanted to ask what your take is on that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's a hugely complicated issue. I certainly do. You know, I was very happy to see the flag go down in the city where I was born, Columbia, South Carolina. It does not belong on, you know, the grounds of state capitals and that sort of thing. So it, as a political symbol, I mean, I don't have a lot of patience for the Confederacy.
Right. right.
You know, I hope to God, had I been alive at that time, I would have been one of the South Carolinians who stood with the Union, and there were some.
I didn't know that, actually, although it stands to reason. But they didn't stand for long, I would reckon.
Well, I think they ran for the Union. Yeah, I don't think South Carolina was a very healthy place for them.
Right.
But there were South Carolinians on both sides in the war. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but there's a different issue there where, and it's for some, you know, poor whites, mostly poor whites in the South and others, that flag, they don't think of it as a flag of slavery or treason. It's become the marker of us, you know, of a group. And somehow, one of the one of the things that gentry whites have done in the South for years is kind of look down on the poor whites and advertise how enlightened and wonderful the gentry whites are by contrasting themselves with these awful trailer park people with their Confederate flags and so on and so forth. And so I think there's a class element. And you know, I don't think the path forward in this country is to indulge in kind of the demonization of groups of America, of fellow Americans. And I would say that about people of all kinds of political views. So somehow there has to be a message of support and inclusion for people, even as one says that the Confederate flag, because of what it means to other people, has no place as a kind of a public celebration of political identity.
Well, I was going to say it seems to pit one group of people against another. It's a symbol that has different meanings to different audiences.
Exactly.
I have always been struck by the fact that insofar as the battle flag of the Confederacy, the stars and bars, is associated with rebellion against the federal government, an effort to secede, the celebration of it by state governments would seem to be wholly inappropriate given the purposes of national unity and so forth. And that should be the first argument against having it flying on the grounds of the state capitol or something like that, that we fought that war, that we've resolved this issue about exactly what the federal government here is, and that such symbolism is inappropriate. But that argument had not been sufficiently weighty to prevent, you know, the anti-integration people in the 1960s from bringing that symbol back into official embrace by state governments as they objected to the feds trying to impose integration on them. It was not sufficient. On the other hand, the injury expressed by African Americans to what that flag symbolizes, references to slavery and so forth, and the driving off of legitimate public discussion of what it represents to other people, which you just expressed, say, lower class whites who look at it as a symbol of pride for their regional and class and kind of cultural distinctiveness. So two things are going on. The latter is being denigrated and the former is being foisted. And that is sufficient to get movement about the placement of the flag on state grounds or on a state, capital or whatever. And that just strikes me as an interesting observation about American politics.
Right. Well, and I think it is, you know, the Confederate flag had largely been laid to rest until the Civil Rights Movement.
Right.
When it was kind of brought out as a... Interesting, one of my father's first church was in the small town of Pinopolis, South Carolina, which is right outside of Charleston. And he, one of the first things he did there was they still carried an old Confederate battle flag in the service, and he stopped that. And it didn't raise a big issue. This was actually before the Civil Rights Movement had really gotten going.
Wow.
And so, you know, this was in a different context. And yeah, you know, a few of the older people in the church missed it, but it didn't cause a big ruckus. Then when the Civil Rights Movement came and that flag came in as a kind of a symbol of resistance to that, a whole new emotional intensity attached to it.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated issue, but it really, you know, I do think, again, as you said, because of what it means, I'm not so much worried about the flag as a symbol of treason, because I don't think there's actually a lot of secessionist sentiment out there.
Okay. I mean,
there's some nut jobs on the internet, but
that's,
we're not worried about the movement to secede in Alabama. In fact, I think there's some people who wish there were such a movement. But I do think that what the flag means to African Americans has never been fully sort of taken on board, and that you just, you know, certainly I wouldn't want to flaunt a symbol of my identity in a way that increased divisions was deemed insulting by other people. It's just or hurtful.
Yeah.
It's just not the way to go.
Yeah. What did you think of the president's performance at that funeral of Clement, of Reverend and State Senator Clemente Pinckney, and honoring of the other victims? Yes.
I think that was one of the great moments of his presidency.
Indeed.
You know, I think that was a time when he really did. He spoke for the United States, and he spoke for all of us. And it was a great performance, and I think it came from the heart.
Yeah, it certainly did. And the spontaneous, it seemed spontaneous. I don't know, maybe it was scripted. Breaking into song at the end. I mean, that was very brave, performing without a net for sure. Just the yep. right touch. You know, I was deeply moved by it, actually.
So was I. And again, you know, to have that going on while I'm staying at a Martin Luther King Center in former East Berlin was a very rich experience.
Yeah. Okay. Walter, I can't thank you enough for giving time, coming on the Glenn Show, talking about the Black Church and where we stand now in American politics and culture and race. So, you know, many thanks, and have a good afternoon.
Well, anytime, Glenn. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye.